This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Ledson. Today, we're heading to Detroit. We're on Chelsea Avenue in the northeast part of the city. Some of the houses here have neatly trimmed lawns and lacy curtains in the windows. Others have chicken wire fences and rusted out cars in the driveways. And then there are the abandoned homes, with the siding ripped off and windows just gaping holes. Detroit used to be home to nearly 2 million people. Then came the collapse of the auto industry. Between that and white flight, more than half of those people left. Today, fewer than 700,000 live in the city of Detroit. That means there are a lot of vacant homes.
It's like a war zone. Rows and rows of abandoned houses.
Paul Sherman's a wrecker. His job is to use an excavator to demolish houses. He works for one of the 20 companies that the city hires to demolish abandoned homes. The city's plan is to knock down 40,000 houses in 9 years. That's a dozen houses every single day. Paul's been in this business for 28 years. His dad was a wrecker before him.
When I was a little boy, my dad would bring us to work. And I mean, back when he was doing it, they were wrecking houses, but not on the mass that we do it now. Like, you'd go down this street, we'd wreck this house, but people would be living all through here.
Not now. Now there are streets with only one or two houses left standing. When we visit, Paul's getting ready to take down a vacant house on Chelsea.
Kind of weighs heavy on your heart because someone lived here at one time. Kids lived in this house, or someone's got to get emotional over that their house is gone.
Paul bites a hole in the roof with the claw of his excavator. Then he pulls down the front wall till the house is open, like a dollhouse. All the while, a member of his crew is spraying the house with a hose hooked up to a fire hydrant. That is to keep the dust down. Within minutes, Paul's finished, and what was once a house is now just a pile of rubble on the ground. But if the demolition isn't done properly, what ends up blowing around in the air?
Kids could get lead poisoned by the distribution of dust from those demolitions or from the soil that is left with lead impregnating it afterwards.
Professor Lyke Thompson at Wayne State University isn't the only one worried about lead poisoning. People across the country have been wondering how lead might be affecting them and their kids ever since news broke of contaminated water in Flint, Michigan in 2016. And home demolitions are a huge concern. The federal government doesn't regulate how contractors should prevent lead from spewing all over the place, so it's done differently across the country. Reporter Eilish O'Neill picks up the story in Detroit's Southwest in a piece she originally brought us back in March.
I stopped by a little bungalow guarded by a pit bull straining on his chain. The front lawn is neat and tidy, but the street is pocked with empty lots and vacant, burned-out houses.
You can park over here.
This is where Ashley and Red Smith live with their family. They've known each other since they were 13, and they've been together since they were 20.
I'm 35, so
yeah, he grew up here.
I grew up around here, so I grew up in this house.
The armchair Red is sitting in has batting coming out of the seat. He seems to barely fit in the chair, and the Smiths and their four kids seem to barely fit in the living room, where they've all crammed in to listen to the interview. A fifth kid is on the way. Red works as a stay-at-home dad.
I like being home with my children. I like raising them. I like to make sure that they know that they're loved.
He's very modest about it, but he does a lot. It's a lot of work.
Red says he quit his job so Ashley could focus on her career in the mortgage industry and also go back to school to get her MBA. The family can't quite make ends meet, so they get a kind of food stamps for mothers and small children. In April of 2017, Ashley went to renew them, and she was told one of the requirements would be a lead test for her 2-year-old son, Red Jr., or RJ. RJ got the test right away, but the results came later.
And then we got paperwork in the mail saying it was high.
RJ's blood lead level was 9. No amount of lead is safe, but any level over 5 is considered elevated, and levels above 10 are considered poisoning. Lead in a baby's blood can cause lasting brain damage, learning disabilities, speech delays, hearing loss, a lowered IQ, and increased hyperactivity and aggression. Ashley and Red say RJ's test results came as a shock.
Finding out about it was like a big surprise, honestly, because he was normal. He was running around, bubbly, just like he is now.
Scares the shit out you, you know. Honest, excuse my French. You want the best for him, so.
In Detroit, nearly 9% of kids under 6 have elevated blood lead levels. Nationally, that number's only 3%. Lead leaves no chemical marker. There's no way to tell if the lead in a baby's body came from water or windowsills or dirt. And RJ's case was a bit of a puzzle because none of his 3 older sisters suffered from lead poisoning. His parents have a theory about that.
This home is over like 100 years old or so, babe, right?
Yeah. Built in 1914.
Yeah, so it's a pretty old house, and he's a boy, so we give him free time. And RJ, can you come here?
Stop.
Can you come here? Yeah, so we let him play, and we try not to restrict him when he wants to get into things. And I think he might have, you know, with all the paint on the porch and whatnot, he probably got into some of that.
There's another way RJ could have gotten exposed to lead when his sisters weren't. The houses on his block that were demolished around the time he was found to be lead poisoned. Studies in cities like St. Louis have shown that living close to a demolition can increase a child's risk of lead poisoning. It all depends on how the demolition is done.
We sat down with experts and handcrafted a protocol that was right for Detroit.
This is Brian Farkas. He's with the Detroit Building Authority, and he's in charge of the city's demolition program.
Where we actually knock a hole in the roof of the house, have a direct nozzle spray in there for about 2 minutes, soaks the entire attic space down, runs down the side of the inside of the house. Then we soak the entire exterior of the house. Then we open up the mist, and then we take the house down. And just from that change alone, I almost see no dust emissions, just from the naked eye.
Experts say there are even more thorough protocols out there. Kent Murray's a professor at the University of Michigan in Dearborn. He's studied the lead dust coming off of demolitions in Detroit, Chicago, and Baltimore.
The city of Baltimore, they're using 2 to 4 fire hoses, and the results of their demolition had been far, far better.
Murray says the houses demolished in Baltimore were closer together than the houses demolished in Chicago and Detroit.
And yet we've seen far higher concentrations of lead, additional lead to the soil and to adjacent homes than we saw in Baltimore.
But Farkas says those methods would be too expensive for Detroit.
I don't think any city in the country is faced with the unique situation Detroit is right now, where you've got potentially 40,000, not 30,000 left, single-family home sites scattered across the city.
RJ's family has lived in Detroit for generations, but newcomers to the city are also affected. The Jefferson Chalmers neighborhood is across the city from where the Smiths live. It's quiet, with stately brick houses and a waterfront park just a few blocks away.
Hello. How are you?
Good. Nice to see you again.
Vanessa Riley Bates and Robert Swafford bought a house here when they moved to Detroit from Chicago about 5 years ago.
You felt like this would be New York in the 1970s.
Yeah.
You get in when it's still a little rough around the edges.
Yeah.
Prices are super low. Uh-huh. Be part of the artist movement and then watch it all bloom from there,
right,
so to speak.
Robert's a contractor who does historic renovations of old houses. And Vanessa's been a stay-at-home mom ever since their son Forrest was born, 2 years ago. Forrest is wearing blue shorts and those kids' sandals that cover most of the foot and buckle around the ankle. He wants to go outside.
Forrest, we're eating dinner right now, and you're going to stay inside right now.
Forrest, let me get your face wiped off, okay, bud?
Robert and Vanessa are typical proud parents. They talk about how sensitive and sweet Forrest is, how many words he knows.
So, when we started out, number one was bear. on this list anyway. Ball, Bird, Dexter, he has a dog, Dada, Mama. Oh, and he knows all kinds of boats, too.
They even keep a list of those words on the refrigerator.
Like he's...
identify a lobster boat.
They've been keeping close tabs on Forrest's development ever since his one-year checkup at the pediatrician. That's when Forrest's blood was first tested for lead.
The pediatrician came back and he said, oh, his levels are high. They're quite high. And I said, well, what does high mean? I mean, and he said, well, we like to see it under 3. 5 is cause for concern. 10 is lead poisoning. And your child has 21. So...
Vanessa says she couldn't eat for weeks after that appointment.
I have definitely felt, like, sick to my stomach, that my, like, baby has poison in his body.
An inspector came to the house and found lead under the drip line outside.
They also found it inside, because we had his, like, toy set up in this room. When they did the inspection, they found it inside of the windowsill wells. And they found it, like, settling on the books. And that's a little strange.
And what's weird about there being lead dust in these windows is these aren't old windows.
No, they're replacement windows.
In other words, the windows themselves have no lead on them. So Robert thinks the lead dust must have come from outside the house.
These windows, the thing about them is that we've got, you know, double sashes, but there's a screen on the outside instead of a storm. Anything can come in through the screen and sit in that trough, even if the windows are closed. So when you open the window, you could potentially just get whatever's, you know, outside blown right in.
And Robert thinks he knows where that lead dust came from. The summer Forrest was lead poisoned, his dad witnessed 2 demolitions just kitty corner from the family's home.
Were you home when that demolition was?
I watched it, yes. And it was absolutely 100% not done lead safe.
Robert's a certified lead safe contractor.
They were taking the wood trim and throwing it out the windows.
That's a problem because the wood trim of old houses is usually covered with lead paint.
And when they demolished, it was a wrecking ball. I mean...
without water.
Without water. No water used whatsoever.
Contractors working for the city aren't supposed to do dry demolitions. But Brian Farkas, the guy in charge of Detroit's ramped-up demolition program, will tell you, one of the biggest challenges since the beginning has been enforcing the rules the city wrote for its contractors.
You can, you know, write the strongest spec you want sitting downtown, but if you're not enforcing it out in the field, you create a culture where cutting corners is rewarded. If I'm a contractor, why am I going to take extra time and money to set up a hose, spray a house down, and soak it while it's being demolished, if I'm seeing a guy over there who's outbidding me, not doing it?
If a demolition is done without water, lead paint can turn into lead dust that can travel nearly 600 feet, reaching about 20 houses from the site of the demolition. When I first spoke to him in 2016, Farkas told me if demolitions were causing lead to turn up in children's blood, he'd look at new ways of demolishing homes or overseeing contractors.
We are hyper, hyper sensitive about the health implications of demolition. If we are causing a problem, we want to know about it before anyone else does, so we can make adjustments immediately.
Here's the thing. Most cases aren't clear-cut like Forrest's. They're more like RJ's, where there are a bunch of ways the child could have been exposed to lead. As with Forrest, after RJ was found to be lead poisoned, an inspector came to the Smith's house and looked in every corner for lead.
They came in and they tested every room, every wall, every piece of jewelry I had, drawers, everything. They tested every toy, the soil, the water.
The water was fine, but the soil...
they just said, like, lead wasn't there, and they fixed it. They put new topsoil down. They covered it with rocks.
Most of Detroit soil has some lead in it, thanks to years of heavy industry. But as Kent Murray's study found, Detroit's demolitions add even more lead to the soil. There's no way to know exactly how lead got into the Smith soil. The inspector found lead inside the house, too, and the Smiths got a grant from the state to fix a lot of the problem.
And to have this, all this, to have brand new windows, a new roof, and the roof was getting ready to cave in. It was, you know, it was breaking down. It was, you know, it was so much that I wanted to do, but I couldn't do because because, you know, you have no credit or this, that, and the other.
It's kind of heartbreaking to think about. Redhead wanted to fix up the house, but he couldn't because he couldn't get a loan. Ashley says she also wishes they could have fixed the house earlier.
Because you're like, oh, I think I messed up, you know.
A lot of parents end up blaming themselves. They wonder if they could have done something differently, when in many cases, there isn't anything they could have done. And Archie's situation is similar to what's happening to toddlers nationwide, especially African Americans. They're more than twice as likely to be lead poisoned as white kids. In Detroit, Public Health Commissioner Abdul El-Sayed studied how demolitions were affecting lead poisoning. His research came out in January 2017.
We could not rule out the possibility that there was some increased risk of elevated blood lead among children who lived close to a demolition.
Specifically, the study found that during warm months, when windows are left open, children living within a block or so of a city demolition were 20% more likely to have increased blood lead levels. If there were two or more demolitions, they were 40% more likely. A month after the study came out, a city task force made recommendations on how to make the demolition program safer. They included notifying residents about when demolitions are happening and what their health risks are. But a year later, neighbors still weren't being informed of upcoming demolitions.
Literally. I left for work. The house was there. I came back. The house was gone.
Alicia Lee lives in southeast Detroit, not too far from where Forrest lives.
We were not notified that they were going to tear it down. At least I wasn't. I came back. The house was gone. The debris was not even there. They had moved everything out. It was just a hole.
Others did receive door hangers with instructions to close doors and windows and keep pets and children inside. But the hangers had no information about lead. The task force also called for better oversight to make sure contractors are following the city's rules. I asked demolition contractor Paul Sherman about that, and he told me nothing had really changed.
Are there contractors who have bad reputations?
Yes. Yes. They know who the bad ones are.
But that doesn't mean they get caught. Sherman told me the inspectors miss most of his demolitions because they happen in the span of just a few minutes. And he says contractors warn each other about surprise visits from the state's Department of Environmental Quality, or DEQ.
Someone always gets a hint somewhere that the DEQ's all riding around. Like my brother works for Adamo. He'll call me and say, hey, I'm over here. DEQ just rolled up on me. They're in the neighborhood. So we all kind of look out for each other, saying, you know, because no one wants to see anybody get in trouble. I mean, it's no water's like a $25,000 fine.
I brought that information back to Stuart Batterman. He's a task force member and a professor of environmental health at the University of Michigan.
Those demolition contractors told me we all have friends who work for the other contractors, so we know when DEQ is riding. We call each other and say, turn your water on. I thought that was an interest.
Discouraging. This is why everyone needs to be inspected.
The city task force recommended that officials start monitoring lead in the soil and air near recent demolitions. I wanted to know what they found out, so I filed a Freedom of Information Act request. The answer I got back was really troubling. There was no record of any lead monitoring despite the city's own promises. I tried to talk with Brian Farkas about this. He's the guy we heard from earlier who's in charge of Detroit's demolition program. I called and emailed him over several months, but he declined to comment. Once lead is found in the blood of kids like RJ, there's only a couple of things doctors can do. Give them medicine to try to remove the lead, or use a special diet. That's what they did in RJ's case.
They really stressed that. Water, 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 water. If you give him juice, put water in the juice. So, yeah, they want more diapers, more wet diapers.
Milk can also help because the calcium competes with lead for absorption. And fruits and vegetables can help carry lead out of the body.
He likes veggies, though. That's the thing about children. If you feed them good while they are this age, they will not know the difference.
I spoke with the Smiths back in the summer of 2017. Since then, Ashley got tested for lead to make sure her baby wasn't being exposed. She was in the clear, thanks to the remodel. On New Year's Day 2018, the Smiths' fifth child was born, a healthy baby boy they named Terrielle. As for RJ, Ashley tells me he's doing well. He talks a lot, he knows all his colors, lots of animals, and he's trying to learn his letters. He'll start preschool in the fall.
Thanks to Alicia O'Neill for bringing us that story. The city found out a year and a half ago that its demolitions were connected to elevated levels of lead in kids. But only now is the city looking to hire a contractor to investigate why that's happening. In the meantime, Detroit has halted demolitions in neighborhoods with the highest rates of lead poisoning. But demolitions are still happening in other parts of the city. We checked with Professor Batterman, and he says he's not sure how safely those remaining demolitions are being done. So, what happens to those lead-poisoned kids when they grow up?
I just feel like that we were collateral damage to make money for the industry.
That's next on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. Today, we're looking at different ways that lead gets into people's lives, in our homes and water, the air and dirt our children play in. Lead affects kids all around the country. KLW reporters Angela Johnson and Marissa Ortega Welch did a deep investigation this year on lead in the San Francisco Bay Area. Marissa and Angela, welcome.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So tell us what you've learned.
There are these hot spots around the country, certain zip codes, certain neighborhoods where kids have really high levels of lead. And one of those hot spots is right here in Oakland, California, in the Fruitvale neighborhood. 7% of kids in the Fruitvale neighborhood of Oakland, California have lead poisoning.
What is it about the Fruitvale area that makes all these lead cases pop up?
The majority of homes in Oakland are pre-1978, which is built before lead paint was banned. So there are all these potential sources, and that's where kids in Alameda County are getting lead poisoning from, the homes.
Lead is a neurotoxin. It kills brain cells. So kids' brains under the age of 6 are still developing. If they are poisoned by lead, that's going to affect their long-term brain health.
So what does that look like in a kid? Like a child that gets lead poisoning, what are the symptoms?
Lead poisoning symptoms are things like loss of appetite, violent behavior, difficulty paying attention, which a lot of kids under the age of 6 might have, right? So you could be sending your kid off to school every day thinking that they just don't sit still well in class or they're fighting a lot with their siblings when actually what's going on is they've got lead poisoning.
Is it reversible? Like once a child gets lead poisoning, is there any coming back from that?
No, the neurological damage is done. You can remove lead from the blood, you can remove lead from the body, but those long-term effects will be there for the rest of the child's life.
Lead gets in the bones, it stays in the bones, it stays in the teeth, and it will release over time. So it's this sort of slow drip toxin, this slow drip killer.
So maybe the most famous case of lead poisoning that Americans can think about right now is what's going on in Flint, Michigan, which still doesn't have clean water. How does that compare to what's happening in East Oakland?
Well, we talked earlier about how the Fruitvale neighborhood in Oakland is this hot pocket of lead poisoning. 7% of kids in the Fruitvale neighborhood of Oakland have a high lead level, a level above 5 micrograms per deciliter of blood. 7%. Flint, Michigan, 5% of those kids had lead poisoning. And we had a national public health crisis. That was making the nightly news for days. It's still not solved. We're still probably not talking about it enough. But Oakland actually has a higher percentage of kids who are lead poisoned, and we're not talking about it.
So as part of your reporting, you followed around a nurse who is trying to help kids that have been poisoned by lead in their homes. Her name is Diep Tran.
I got to see him because I saw him in the hospital after he was born. Oh, I'm not sick, so I can hold him.
Yeah, we got to tag along with Diep as she visits these families, does her casework. She is dealing with about 30 new cases every year. She's working with about 150 families at one time.
It's a lot. It's a lot. And it shows. She's very passionate about her work. She's very animated. But it seems like she never stops working. She works on the weekends. She works when she can visit families. So that means going to their house after work, going in the morning, calling at lunch hours. She knows all these families, too, even though she's dealing with 150 at a time.
Ooh, somebody's growing up fast. He was light before. Now he's heavy.
She is part of a department of people who will come out and actually repaint homes and do other support services.
Oh, look at this face.
She's super animated. It was actually really hard to record her because she's running around the room. She gets really excited. She slams on the table. She whispers and then she'll yell something really loudly. So she was, you know, she's really, really passionate about this work. And she tells us that sometimes she doesn't sleep at night because she's worried about what she's going to do the next morning.
So what does her day look like? I mean, you guys embedded with her, traveled around the county with her. What exactly does she do?
When a kid in Alameda County tests high for lead poisoning, she's deployed to their house.
I've seen parents go into shock. Most of them are anxious. Some feel guilty and go into denial, which is not good for the child because parents in denial don't want to work with us. They practically slam the door in our faces. And how can the child recover if we don't help the family?
The first thing she's doing is she's helping them determine where the lead is coming from. And then the county has some resources to even try to do some lead abatement. But she's also doing things like nutrition counseling. There's certain foods that kids can be eating to help with lead poisoning, to help keep the body from absorbing lead.
And one of the most important things that she's doing is helping these families find new housing. Because one of the best ways to bring down a child's lead levels is to remove the source of lead. And if you can't paint over it or a landlord is unwilling to fix peeling paint, you have to get the child out of the house. One of the shocking things we learn from her is that sometimes she actually has to refer a family and tell them to go to a homeless shelter.
It's my job to make sure that if they want to move in order for the child to recover from lead poisoning, but they can't afford to, I have to find them housing, lead-free housing that's affordable. So that's another part of my job. Other nursing programs have their own social workers, at least one. We don't have any. So I put them in a homeless shelter because once they're in the shelter, their chance of getting hopefully affordable and less safe housing jumps up.
They're more likely to get affordable housing when they're in a homeless shelter rather than just looking around the Bay Area.
After a low-income family moves out, the property owners repaint and remodel the apartment or the house and can charge double or triple the price.
How do we put an end to this problem of kids being poisoned in their homes? I mean, it seems preventable. So besides gentrifying the whole neighborhood, what's the solution?
Well, it is preventable, and that would just be making sure that when kids move into a home, there's no lead in the home. And there are examples around the country of cities and areas that have tried to remove sources by doing these rental inspection programs where landlords would be responsible before they could rent their apartment to a family to make sure that the apartment was tested for lead and that the sources were removed. And we found this example in Rochester, New York, that really reduced childhood lead poisoning rates by a lot.
They committed to proactively inspecting all rental units in the city. And in the 10 years that they did that, they brought their childhood lead levels down by 80%.
And so Alameda County, the Healthy Homes Department, the Lead Poisoning Prevention Program, they've been trying to get Oakland City Council to adopt something similar to that Rochester model for almost a decade. And it, for many different reasons, it keeps getting pushed back, but that's what they want to do.
Other countries around the world banned lead paint as early as 1920s. The U.S. got around to it in 1978. Here we are in 2018, and there are still kids who are getting lead poisoned. So it's not a huge number, but it's certainly a number of kids in Oakland who are continuing to be poisoned by something that we have known for basically 100 years is something we shouldn't have in our environment.
Now I have to work harder because our plan was for lead poisoning to be gone, eradicated by 2010. And yet, we're still getting too many cases.
O Oakland and other cities around California are supposed to give money to help their lead cleanup programs after they won a $600 million lawsuit against three paint companies. One company agreed to settle, but the other paint companies are appealing to the U.S. Supreme Court. For more on Angela Marissa's reporting on lead in San Francisco's East Bay, listen to their series.
All of those radio stories are available on KALW.org.
The funkiest public radio station in the system. Thank you, ladies, for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Diep Tran, the public health nurse we just heard from, works to prevent lead poisoning in kids. So what happens to children who are exposed to high levels of lead but grow up with no treatment? Idaho's Silver Valley is one place to look.
You see all the green? None of that was there. Back when the smelter was going, that was all brown.
Miners have been digging silver, zinc, and lead out of the mountains there since the late 1800s. In 1917, the Bunker Hill Mining Company opened a lead smelter in the valley to get the valuable metal out of the rocks. Paul grew up in Kellogg and Smelterville, towns on either side of the smelter.
This little blue house here was my mom and stepdad's house. I lived in between that house and the one in Smelterville.
During Paul's childhood, that smelter was going full blast.
Oh, I remember the metal feeling in your teeth from it. I remember not being able to see across the playground because it was so smoky. It was bad.
Paul went to Silver King Grade School. It's gone now, but back then it was just downhill from the smelter.
It was their wastewater, I believe, that ran right behind the school. Because I remember if a ball went over the fence or anything, it was gone. You couldn't go get it. It was in the wastewater coming out of the smelter.
In 1973, a fire badly damaged what's called the baghouse of the smelter. That's the place with filters to control air pollution. Paul was a toddler then. Do you remember anything about that?
The only thing I remember from that is it ate the paint off our car in front of our house. So they gave my dad a check to get a paint job because he had a nice car and he wanted to get it repainted.
It ate the paint off of your father's car. Did people talk about this, or was it just like, you know, an open secret that no one really said anything?
Me and my friends talk about it behind closed doors. I just feel like that we were collateral damage to make money for the industry. That's how I feel about it.
This feeling of being collateral damage is so strong for Paul because after that fire, the smelter kept running, but with sharply reduced pollution controls. Lead exposure shot up dramatically. But people didn't know, or they put their jobs first. Miners kept mining, and kids kept doing what kids do.
My thing was going to the lake and water skiing. That's what I like to do.
What about school itself? Did you like going to school?
No, I wasn't. I hated school. I had all kinds of problems in school, yeah.
Tell me about them. What was going on?
I was frustrated all the time. Schoolwork frustrated me. The concentrating, and it was too much for me. As far as organizing anything or planning anything, that's really, really difficult stuff for me to do. And it really frustrates me.
How about your memory? Is your memory good?
No. Sometimes, but no. Dates, times, I don't remember a lot of things.
In the months after the baghouse fire, lead emissions from the smelter averaged almost 30 times higher than the Clean Air Act allowed. The year Paul turned 4, local health officials started testing for lead. 99% of the children living within a mile of the smelter had lead levels in their blood considered hazardous, even then. You were tested for lead 3 times as a kid. Why'd you do it?
Because they asked us to. We did it because they paid us money as kids. If you go get your lead tested, you got $15 or something. That's why we did it.
When Paul was 9, 11, and 12 years old, his blood lead levels ran between 20 and 30 micrograms per deciliter. CDC guidelines now say kids with that much lead in their blood need to get checked out by a doctor right away. So, did you get help right away?
I wasn't even told. I didn't even know my lead levels till 2004.
Did your parents know?
They said they didn't.
Paul got his test results from local health officials when he was 33 years old. How did you feel when you first saw the tests that you took as a kid and saw what those numbers were?
I went to my doctor. He said that they were nothing to be concerned about. But I know that me and my friends had lots of problems. So when the computers came out, I researched it and I learned different.
Paul has had many problems that have long been tied to childhood lead exposure. Trouble learning, dropping out of school, hypertension. After Paul quit school, he worked in the mining industry.
I was 17. I worked at the Bunker Hill with my dad. I liked it a lot. I just did different things, hauling muck and stuff underground.
His dad experienced another dark side of mining, one of the deadliest U.S. mine fires back in 1972. 91 miners were killed. Paul's dad, Ron Flory, was rescued after spending a week 4,000 feet underground.
Tried to figure out in our own minds what they were doing to get down to us. We knew they had to come down to get us out.
This is Ron talking to a local news station in 2010.
Really good feeling to get out when we got out.
He passed away last year. What was your dad's take on the pollution?
He knew about it. It was something that bothered him because I think he knew that the effect it had on me. I think it was something that he really didn't deal with or want to deal with until just before he passed.
What was his thoughts on it? I mean, what did he say to you?
He didn't know what to say. It's just a really messed up subject. He didn't know what to say.
Before you understood what was going on with the lead poisoning, did you have any suspicions that it was lead poisoning? Like, how did that all play out?
We kind of knew because there were settlements. There were a bunch of settlements and a bunch of people left. I mean, we knew something was going on.
We don't know how many children the lead harmed in the Silver Valley, but a study of nearly 300 adults who grew up there at the same time as Paul found they had significantly more neuropsychiatric symptoms than a control group. The mining company settled one lawsuit brought on behalf of 9 children for about $10 million. A class action followed, ending with payments to 36 more kids. Paul says his family didn't sue because they weren't sure how to go about it at the time. What does justice look like to you?
I would just like to have somebody that knows about lead sit down and talk to me about it, a doctor. That would be the biggest thing for me.
Idaho still offers free lead tests to people living in the area. 35 years ago, Kellogg and Smelterville were declared a part of a toxic Superfund site. In 2002, that was expanded to contaminated sites over 1,500 square miles. A lot has been cleaned up, but families in the Silver Valley are still told not to let their kids play in the dirt. You can try to stop your kids from playing in the dirt, but keeping lead away from wildlife, well, that's tougher. How bullets are spreading lead in the wild. Coming up next on Reveal. From the Center for Investigative Reporting in PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Ledson. Old paint and demolition dust are two big sources of lead that hurt people. But lead is also spread by bullets. President Obama's administration said that's why they tried to phase out lead ammunition on certain federal lands on their last day in office. But President Trump's Interior Secretary, Ryan Zinke, overturned that order his first day on the job. Reveal's Emily Harris went to Wyoming to learn more.
And so the magazine goes in here.
It's a below freezing December morning in Wyoming's Bridger Teton National Forest.
And then this is the safety.
Brian Bedrosian gets ready to shoot a deer. He loads just one bullet into the magazine, even though it can hold four.
You're going to kill this deer with one shot.
You're going to kill this deer with one shot.
We were laughing because the white-tailed deer was already dead before Brian shot it.
Guess we'll see if I'm a good shot or not, huh?
A car hit it the day before. Brian got the corpse from the highway cleanup crew. We hauled it out here, we set it up on a log, and shot it with a lead bullet, all to understand the impact of lead bullets on wildlife.
And the entry wound is always small.
Brian's a hunter. He's also a bird biologist.
Yeah. Wait, now is that the bullet hole? That big rip under the left leg?
Yeah, so there's a bullet hole right there. And then in, out.
The physics of bullets is good to understand here. And it's fascinating. When a lead bullet hits a deer or an elk or any game, its shape immediately starts to change.
And so the bullet hits, and when it hits, the front of the bullet starts to mushroom.
It collapses back, sort of?
It either collapses back or kind of peels back, just depending on the type of bullet you're using. But yeah, so the whole front half of the bullet will essentially, if you pulled it out, it would look like a mushroom.
Studies using X-rays have found that lead fragments can travel through an animal's muscle and guts to more than a foot away from the bullet hole. That's because as a lead bullet releases its energy inside the animal, it can break into fragments as small as dust.
And so you could see that, you know, a little bit of the blood came out here.
After shooting an animal, many hunters just take the meat they want with them, leaving piles of potentially lead-tainted guts for eagles and other wildlife to munch on.
The smaller the particle, the more dangerous it is, because the smaller it is, the easier it is to pass through the digestive system. The acids eat it up quick, and it gets fully assimilated into the bird's system.
Our next stop is the Raptor Rehabilitation Center that Brian runs, just south of Grand Teton National Park.
So here on our left is the Raptor Center.
The center is in a soaring, old Gothic-style barn in a broad river valley with snow-capped mountains all around.
So this is the Raptor barn where we house all of our educational birds, and then this is our rehab barn. And this is Megan Warren, our rehabilitation director.
And chief snow shoveler.
Chief snow shoveler.
At least today. Hi, Megan.
Hi. Just...
Megan takes us inside to a small lab space. She introduces me to a Eurasian eagle owl named K2. K2 spits out a pellet of bone bits and rodent fur from his last meal, as raptors do. In a dark room off this lab space, a golden eagle is resting. He was brought here with lead poisoning a couple of weeks ago.
And this bird, in addition to lead, a blood lead level, he also collided with something and had some head and eye trauma.
Lead poisoning can affect a bird's balance, so it can't fly right. Lead can also shut down a bird's digestive system.
Okay, we ready?
It's time for treatment. Megan quietly opens the eagle's cage. Recorded forest sounds play to keep him calm. Megan and a volunteer cover the eagle's eyes with a little leather hood. They protect his tail with a plastic sleeve.
You hold his head.
The eagle gets antibiotics, an anti-inflammatory, a medicine to help his stomach problems, also eye drops. He's just finished his last round of medicine to take out the lead.
You inject it under the skin, and the lead binds with that molecule, and then it puts it into a form that the body can then pass through the urinary tract.
How does it compare to what a human goes through for lead treatment?
It's the same.
Exact same.
Exact same.
Like people, more exposure to lead makes birds sicker. How sick also depends on the species.
So if you're an eagle that's 20 years old and every year you get exposed to lead during the big game hunting season, and then this year you have just even a little bit, you know, of exposure, it's enough to tip you over the edge. And condors, on the other extreme, are extremely sensitive to it at lower levels.
To save the condor, California has banned all lead bullets. It's the only state to have gone that far. Other states do have some restrictions on lead ammunition. And as we mentioned, the Trump administration reversed an Obama decision to fully phase out lead on some federal lands. Lead bullets are allowed on the National Elk Refuge in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. It's our next stop.
How's it going?
Good, how are you?
Good.
In a parking lot out on the refuge, we find Caleb Putt, a burly drywall guy.
He's bagged at least one elk a year around here since he was a teenager. That's a couple decades worth of elk. He's tracking a herd on the hillside through his binoculars.
You want to look?
Yeah, thank you. Mm-hmm. There are hundreds up there.
Thousands, actually.
That's thousands, you think?
I would think there's probably about 2,000.
I ask him whether he uses lead or lead-free ammunition. He's been really friendly, but with this question, he looks hard at me and replies carefully.
It just depends on what I'm hunting with. And you can use lead-free bullets, but they're not as... The trajectory, for some reason, isn't quite as good.
Brian jumps into the conversation, and the two of them chat guns and bullet specs in great detail for a couple of minutes. Then Brian points to the logo on his jacket.
I'm a Raptor Center guy.
And shows his biologist side.
I would put a plug in for the eagles to use non-lead.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. But
What happens to the eagles?
About two-thirds of the eagles we test out here on the refuge and in the park have elevated lead, and about a third have poisoning levels from the fragmentation in the gut piles.
Interesting.
Brian tells Caleb about an experiment he ran with hunters in the area.
It was 2012-13. I handed out free ammo.
Oh, really?
And then sold it at cost for about 2 years. And as the number of hunters using non-lead increased, we saw a corresponding decrease of lead in the eagles.
Man, that's awesome.
Yeah, so I was pretty psyched about it.
Oh, and I thought you were just about to give me a box of bullets.
Brian's research matches other studies. Caleb's back to feeling friendly. Brian takes the plunge.
Let me ask you this. Why don't you use non-lead?
I guess just because I favor the trajectory and the way this shoots through my weapon.
Hunters groups often say that non-lead bullets don't shoot as well. Texas and Arizona got hunters to try non-lead and then asked them what they thought. The vast majority said lead-free bullets worked just fine. Brian asked Caleb, well, what if...
Let's say, you know, you were taking out your neighbor's kid or something. Would you promote him using non-lead in his gun?
Oh, well, that's a good question. That's a good question. No. I got to tell you, I probably fall in that group of people that haven't given it enough consideration.
Yeah.
And Brian leaves it there.
Next time you see me out here, bring me a box of bullets.
Brian wants to get rid of lead bullets, but in a way that hunters will accept. He has some hope because duck hunters switched over to lead-free shot after a federal ban 20 years ago. As we hike up a short, steep hill on the elk refuge, I ask Brian what he thought about Caleb.
Okay, when I first said lead bullets, he totally looked me over like,
yep.
Who the hell are you and what do you want?
Yep, yeah.
You caught that look too?
Oh, absolutely. His whole body position shifted, which is not uncommon. Yeah, this is a long-term play. It's going to take a generational shift. You know, if somebody starts hunting with non-lead, they'll hunt non-lead their whole life.
He didn't know about the eagles, though.
No, and that's, it's good for me to hear that he didn't know about the eagles, and he was open to it. He seemed like a very educated and ethical hunter.
Caleb had suggested Brian work up a simple visual he could show elk hunters. Brian's already figured that out. He uses the elk guts that hunters leave behind.
So I'm just looking. There's a gut pile. All right, so you see...
On this bright, clear winter day on the refuge, piles of elk innards dot the frozen grass of the wide plain.
There's a lot of black specks out there.
How high up?
On the ground. They're all on the ground.
Oh, yeah. See them, yes.
That's a feeding frenzy. There's a bunch of eagles in there, too. I could see some white heads.
A half a dozen bald eagles feast on one pile.
Let's stop and take a look.
As we approach, they scatter.
Oh, that is a gut pile.
Oh, yeah.
Brian slits the elk's stomach.
And this can sometimes get a little ripe.
And dumps out stinky, half-digested grasses.
Ew.
It's pretty gross.
Let's throw it in the sled.
He moves the pile to a sled. We collect a couple more and then load all three gut piles onto his truck. And then we head back to the Raptor Center to x-ray them.
That's elk gut pile number one.
Yeah, so this is one of the ones that the birds were feeding on.
We don't see much in the first two x-rays, but the third is different.
In this corner.
Bright white dots grouped together. Brian says this is how metal shows up on x-rays.
They're pretty small little particles, but I do think it's lead. Not a ton, but still enough to make an eagle sick.
Then we x-ray the deer we know was shot with a lead bullet because we did it.
All right, let's get the x-ray plate ready on the ground.
Okay. He arranges the deer corpse on the x-ray plate.
Okay, let's try that.
Stands over it and pushes go. It takes a couple minutes to process and to get the image on the computer screen, but no time at all to find the bullet wound.
Yeah.
I think I can already see why it flecks.
You sure can.
A channel.
Bright spots are clearly grouped around the bullet hole. Brian zooms in. With just his eyeball and a ruler, he finds metal about 4 inches from the bullet wound. He tries to count the flecks, but there are too many.
One lead bullet. Hundreds, hundreds of fragments.
Studies have found enough particles of lead in game meat that several states caution young children and pregnant women about eating game shot with lead. Direct harm to humans isn't clear. But Brian knows that what we see on this x-ray is enough to seriously hurt any wildlife that would have scavenged it. Killing eagles is a federal crime. Punishment is a $100,000 fine or a year in jail. But there is no penalty for death by lead bullet dust.
Thanks to Emily Harris for bringing us that story. She's also the lead producer on today's show. Michael Schiller produced our story on lead poisoning in Oakland, California. Laura Starcheski, Michael Montgomery, and Phoebe Petrovic also helped out on today's show, along with editor Deb George. Our production manager is Mwende Anaosa. Our sound design team is the dynamic duo, Jay Breezy, Mr. Jim Briggs, and Fernando, my man, Yo Aruda. They had help this week from Catherine Raimondo. Our theme music is by Camarado, Lightning. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reeve and David Logan Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Heising Simons Foundation, and the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Letson, and remember, there is always more to the story.